Why have you decided to seek another term representing the second district?
Well, first, thanks for having me on, Jason. I really do appreciate it. I always enjoy being interviewed by you and talking to the folks in the region there. Look, this is all about the middle class. That's what I've been fighting for the last 6 years, especially during this dramatic and significant economic downturn we've been experiencing. It is about doing everything we can to make sure that those who are in the middle class stay in the middle class. And if they have the opportunity to do better, that's great. Doing everything that I can as a congressman to get those who have fallen out of the middle class over the years back in. And then beyond that, doing what I can to make sure that those who are out there and are like I was when I was growing up in poverty with a single-parent mom who struggled with mental illness, doing what I can, if those folks are willing to take the responsibility to pull themselves up as I did when I was young and made that decision when I was young, making sure that they have every opportunity to join the middle class and achieve the American dream. So that's the bottom line.
What direction? There's so much talk about where the country is going. Where do you see the country going right now?
Well, I think we're in a situation where we're just slowly beginning to get back on the right track. But we have so far to go. You know, when we talk about the Iowa unemployment rate being what it is, less than the national average, that doesn't mean anything to the factory worker who's been laid off because of unfair foreign competition or unfair trade deals, whatever the case may be. They want a job, or someone who is put out of work and is now working at a convenience store, and they really, you know, could be working somewhere else, putting their skills to good use. Or when we see job openings, but there aren't folks who have the proper skills to fill those jobs, that's disheartening. That's upsetting. We've got to make sure that we balance the openings that are there with the folks that are out there who, if they had the opportunity, would go back to school. They get the training they need and acquire the skills so that they can fill those jobs. That's what I'm hearing from folks. That's what's very, very concerning to me. And as you might imagine, and has been, so long as folks are out of work, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure they have the opportunity to get back on the job.
What is the most important thing that Congress can do to help job growth, job creation, people advancing in jobs and such?
Well, I think the focus on education has to be the key. I think we can have a bipartisan agreement, although I'm not sure where my opponent stands on that. I mean, he's in favor of abolishing the Department of Education. To me, that goes in the wrong direction. But I think education is the key. And as you know, I focused pretty significantly on community colleges, certainly post-secondary education, but community colleges are really the key, I think, in many ways here to job training and therefore job growth, getting those folks into those positions that I hear that are out there. And then my sector's bill, which is a part of that too, doing what we can in a limited way, but what we can nonetheless, federal level, to assist local communities to identify where the jobs can be created, which industries are growth industries, and then making certain that the folks at the local area, the stakeholders, including those community colleges, are able to come together, identify those growth areas, and just make certain that folks have the skills they need to fill those positions.
How do you get enough to community colleges? I mean, they have faced cuts in recent years where they're having to sometimes get rid of programs instead of adding them. What do you do to help the community colleges prepare these workers?
Well, I think the federal government has a very limited role, if any role, in terms of actual funding of the community colleges' operations. That's at the state and local level. What I'm talking about is making certain that we have Pell Grants available to students, making certain that we have those low-interest loans that I worked so hard on available to those students. And then, of course, including the community colleges, as we've already done in Iowa to a great extent, including those local community colleges in those community discussions about the industries that the local community wants to move forward or to save or to create, so that the community colleges, because they are really where we're going to be training the vast majority of those folks, so they're part of that conversation.
There's a lot of talk about the tax cuts, obviously. Some say that if you maintain the tax cuts, that jobs will be created and such. Others say that the upper level tax cuts should be eliminated. Where do you stand on that?
Well, the bottom line is that wherever this ends up, the middle class has to be protected. That's the bottom line. The middle class cannot be held hostage to this discussion that's going on, this argument that's going on. Yeah, there are different sides to this issue. My own particular bill that I introduced is really an attempt to bring the sides together, to forge a compromise. That's what people tell me all the time they want us to do. And my particular bill would in fact, keep in place the Bush-era tax cuts for those up to $250,000, and then $250,000 and above. Of course, it would go back to the Clinton-era tax rates. But it would also exclude or exempt all of those small businesses, not just some of them, but all the small businesses at $250,000 and above. And also would exempt family farms. Very, very critical here in Iowa, both of those groups of folks. So I think we can find a compromise on this. But whatever we do, we cannot hold the middle class hostage. That's the bottom line.
You talk about the idea of finding a compromise, but there is so much divisiveness in Washington. How does that culture change?
Well, I think that some of us are already working on that. And as you know, I'm a member and a leader in a number of these groups, whether it's the Fix Congress Now group or the Common Grounds group, these kinds of groups that include members from both parties, where we get together fairly often and talk about how we're going to find a common ground on issues and how we're going to move this country forward, even if the respective leaderships are not willing to do so at this point. That's what it's going to take. It's going to take, just as it takes a grassroots effort out in the country, in my district, it takes folks coming up to me at the Hy-Vee or at a local convenience store and expressing their views as they do, and the closer we get to the election, the more they do it. But it's going to take folks in Congress themselves getting their act together, coming together, as I've tried to do the last 6 years, and I think I've done it successfully, forging compromises across the aisle and doing everything I can. When I was in the majority, my sector's bill got bipartisan support, significant bipartisan support. And then moving beyond that, now that I'm in the minority, doing everything I can to take advantage of the relationships that I created, that I forged over that four-year period, so I can now get into law as I did. Of course, my bill that allows the National Guard to embed a mental health provider in every unit, to expand education for our Guard and our Reserve under the GI Bill. Those are the kinds of things I'm very proud that I've gotten accomplished, and I've done it on a bipartisan basis. So, I think leading by example is the way to do this.
There's so much talk. We've talked about numbers and such in terms of tax cuts and such, but the budget and the deficit has received so much discussion. I guess the national debt, so many different ways that people describe when you're talking in the area of $15 to $16 trillion. How do you propose to start dealing with that and getting that down?
Well, it's really unfortunate it's come to this where, again, that bitter partisanship in Washington, D.C. has just held us up. Last year, I was one of the folks who was helping to lead the way on a bipartisan basis. We had over 100 members of the House of Representatives who said, we've got to go big on this. We've got to do $4 trillion over the next 10 years of deficit reduction. At the same time, I joined with a Republican from Michigan to help craft a balanced budget amendment that was introduced. I was the first Democrat to sign on to that bill. I voted for a balanced budget amendment as well. I think we've got to just knuckle down here, get serious about this, put the partisanship aside. We've got to certainly move beyond, the concern out there. If you look at the other side of the aisle, unfortunately, what we've got is a lot of Tea Party folks who don't believe in a balanced approach to this, which is what we have to do. I mean, they've rejected even a 10-to-1 ratio in terms of cuts to revenue being generated. We've got to move beyond that and beyond the partisan bitterness that is out there and get serious about this. But I really do believe that the best way we're going to balance the budget, the way we're going to cut the deficit in the short term and work in the longer term on the national debt issue that you mentioned, is to get people back to work, to get the economy back on its feet. That's going to do wonders.
Can sequestration be avoided?
I think it can, but only if, again, if Congress and the President get serious about this. I voted against the bill that, set in motion the events that we're now seeing unfold, what will happen, as you know, if there's no action on the part of Congress and the President, is that we're going to see $1.2 trillion in cuts put in motion automatically, $500 billion or so in the Defense Department, $500-600 billion in discretionary funding. We're talking about a lot of hits to education and other areas that are going to be automatically cut. And I this is really an unthinking way of doing it. Congressmen are not getting paid, you know, to just simply vote in a very simplistic way for automatic cuts. We've got to sit down and think very hard, very seriously about this. My big fear, too, is we're going to see a 2% reduction in the Medicare provider reimbursement rates. That's unacceptable, especially in the state of Iowa, where, you know, Iowa's doing a great job in terms of providing Medicare, providing health care, yet Iowa's ranked at or near the bottom when it comes to reimbursement rates. These are a lot of reasons why I voted against this in the first place.
One of the issues, and I know Governor Romney has said several times that one of his first things he would do in office is repeal what's become known as Obamacare.
Sure.
Obviously, that would be a pretty contentious vote in Congress. Is Obamacare a good thing for this country?
I do believe that there are a lot of really great provisions there. I've talked about that many times. My opponent also wants to repeal it. And let me tell you what's going to happen if my opponent gets in there and if Mitt Romney gets in there and this gets repealed. The 25-year-old who now cannot find insurance at his or her place of work, but it's on her parents' health insurance policy, is now going to be kicked off. Those children with pre-existing conditions who are now on a health insurance plan because under the law they cannot be denied health insurance are going to be kicked off their health insurance plan. Seniors who now are on Medicare Part D and they've seen that donut hole for prescription drugs closed by 50%, suddenly are going to see that donut hole completely open. It's going to cost them another $600 to $700 a year. Seniors who now can get free annual checkups and preventative care without copays and deductibles, they're going to have to go back to the bad old days when they were paying out of their pocket for these things. Women, are going to be faced again with higher premiums just because they're women. It doesn't make any sense at all to do this as far as I'm concerned.
What would you say to those that say, because of the costs, we're not going to hire new people, we're not going to do this? How would you respond to them?
Well, I think that, obviously we've got to look at this situation by situation. And if you're talking about small businesses, the fact of the matter is small businesses who have 50 or fewer employees do not have to have health care for their employees. And those who are 20, who have 25 and fewer do not have to have health care provided, health insurance provided under the law. But they can get up to a 35% tax credit when they do provide health insurance for their employees. So there are a lot of things in this for small businesses that are very advantageous.
In terms of two of the biggest issues when it comes to the budget, we touched on the budget, kind of tying off of Obamacare, is Social Security, Medicare, two issues that are really starting to become more and more prominent in the discussion of this election. In terms, we'll start off with Social Security. It's a program that some say need to change just to be sustainable for even the short-term future. What do you see needs to be done with Social Security to continue it on for people receiving it now and people in the future?
I think we're going to have to look at a lot of different options. But first, let me just say that you may have heard that recently my opponent said that he considered a real weakness in this country those folks who are on Social Security, those folks who are now on Medicare. This is not a real weakness of America. This is a strength of America. And I think you know what I'm referring to, the quote that is attributed to him in a radio interview back in May.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to do everything we can to make certain that Medicare or in Social Security are there, not only for those who are now rightfully receiving those benefits, but for future generations as well. And on the Social Security front, you know, my opponent was asked at one point, not that long ago, are you for privatization of Social Security? And he had a one-word response, and it was absolutely. As far as I'm concerned, privatization of Social Security is the wrong way to go. I think you've heard me talk about the fact that my grandma, when I moved in with her in the fourth grade, was receiving Social Security benefits because my grandpa had died. I got Social Security survivor benefits when I went to Iowa State after my dad died when I was a senior in high school. This is personal, and privatization of Social Security and turning that trust fund over to Wall Street and really gambling with seniors' futures is simply the wrong way to go.
Would you support would you support a higher age for qualifications, or maybe even a reduction of benefits for people that are in their 30s and 40s, not people that are getting close to using it, but the ones several decades away?
No reduction in benefits, no. Folks put their money into Social Security. They should be able to get what they deserve in their retirement. As far as raising the age, I have real qualms about that because, look, there are a lot of folks in this country, millions of folks, who literally engage in almost backbreaking jobs while they're adults. They cannot possibly be expected to work until they're 67, 68, 69, or 70. They're physically unable to continue to do that. So, no, I don't agree that it's a good idea to raise the retirement age beyond what it is now.
Medicare, the other one that's kind of become a big issue in this point here. How do we continue to sustain Medicare?
Look, again, my opponent has talked about voucherization of Medicare. He's trying to walk that back down. Now he's trying to claim it's called a premium support. Whatever one wants to call it, it is a voucher. And if anyone thinks that the government giving you $6,000 to go out on the private insurance market and expect you to get the same kind of coverage that you get under Medicare right now is completely out of touch with the reality of healthcare and what seniors would face in terms of their healthcare choices. It would cost them at least $6,400 out of their pocket. I oppose voucherization of Medicare. At the same time, what I've already voted for, the Affordable Care Act, increases the length of Medicare by 8 years. Under the Ryan plan, the Medicare itself will not be sustainable beyond 2016, and the Ryan plan is what my opponent supports. Beyond that, we've got to move away from Medicare reimbursement rates based on fee-for-service to Medicare reimbursement rates based on quality of care. We know from Iowa's experience that this is the way to go, that this is how Medicare is going to be as efficient as possible, and how that's really going to bend the cost curve in the long term.
How close is that to becoming a reality? I mean, how close is legislation to do that? Because it is, Iowa is towards the bottom when it comes to receiving that. How close is that?
Well, with the Affordable Care Act, a number of hospitals and doctors in Iowa already received an increased benefit because of that geographic disparity and that fix that I was able to get into the law. And then, of course, moving us from a Medicare reimbursement rate based on fee-for-service to one based on value is going to take some years. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, the Affordable Care Act, as I said, has already added 8 years to the life of Medicare. So we've got time to do this, but the sooner the better, no doubt.
Another issue that is near and dear to so many people is what's going on in Afghanistan, the troops. The president has said 2014. You have come out even sooner. Where do you stand when it comes to bringing the troops home from Afghanistan?
Well, you know, look, I've been to Afghanistan 6 times, as you know. One of my children, my stepson, served in Afghanistan. He also served in Iraq, and my daughter-in-law, his spouse, served in the Marine Corps. Both of them served in the Marine Corps. She served in Iraq as well. And I'm on the Armed Services Committee. You know, I hear the testimony. I read the intelligence reports. As I said, I've been there 6 times. I talk to our troops when they come back. The fact of the matter is, I think that we've accomplished what we set out to do. Osama bin Laden has been brought to justice. The Afghan National Security Forces are being stood up. Al-Qaeda has been dispersed in Afghanistan. It is time to bring those troops back. It is time to nation build in America, not in Afghanistan. And beyond that, you know, we have threats worldwide. That's a fact. And somehow maintaining 66,000 troops in Afghanistan is really going to constrain our ability to meet those threats around the world should the need arise. Hopefully we're not going to be committing troops at all in the future or anytime soon, but in the event that we have to make sure that we have the troops on hand, we have the troops we need in the event of another contingency.
In kind of the next area that people have talked about is Iran. Would you, if it meant Iran not getting a nuclear weapon, would you support military action there?
Well, military action can never be taken off the table when it comes to protecting America's vital national interests. But at the same time, I really don't want to engage in a hypothetical, as you might imagine, when it comes to that situation. What I know is that our generals, our diplomatic corps, the experts in the region, have all said that we've got to do everything we can to continue to let economic sanctions work. And if we have to tighten them, then that's the way to go. I've consistently voted for these economic sanctions. We know that they are beginning to be felt by the leadership in Iran. That's the way we need to go. Again, we have to keep all options on the table. We all agree that that Iran should not be allowed to possess a nuclear weapon. At the same time, I think we've got to move in the direction of non-military action at this point, do everything we can short of military action, but never take it off the table.
You've done a number of things, and we kind of touched on it earlier, when it comes to veterans' issues. Is there anything on your radar when it comes to that? What is the next step for returning veterans?
Well, I think we've got to be extremely vigilant, you know, now that all these folks are coming back from Afghanistan. You know, those 66,000 are going to be coming back. We're going to have to devote more resources. Thankfully, in the sequestration process that you talked about earlier, the VA is exempt from those cuts, as should be the case. And so we've got to continue to make sure we provide the benefits for those folks coming back. We're going to see caseloads increase for those folks who are helping them when they return, and we're going to have to put more resources into that. I have absolutely no doubt about it. You know, those folks were voluntarily willing to go abroad and make the ultimate sacrifice to protect this country, to protect our freedoms, to protect our democracy, and we've got to treat them with the dignity and the respect they deserve. I don't think we should spare any cost to do everything we can to make sure that we treat them the way they should be treated. They shouldn't have to fight for an education. They shouldn't have to fight for a roof over their head. They shouldn't have to fight for proper medical care. And we've just got to make sure that we continue to stay on top of this.
Another key area, really for your district and for the state of Iowa in general, is the Farm Bill. Would you support pulling the food stamp portion, the food nutrition and such portion, out of the bill if it meant getting the farm aspects, the agricultural aspects, approved?
No one who's been working closely on this farm bill thinks that's a good idea. So, no, I don't think that's a good idea. This is a farm, food, energy, jobs bill. The fact of the matter is, what we've got is a leadership in the House of Representatives, Republican leadership, that has held this thing up at every step of the way. There was a farm bill that was reported out of the committee. It should have been on the floor of the House of Representatives in late July, early August, before John Boehner sent the House of Representatives home for a vacation. That didn't happen. I led the Iowa House delegation in that effort on a bipartisan basis to get a disaster relief bill because of the drought, and I and a number of others were working as hard as we possibly could to get that farm bill itself, which included disaster relief, onto the floor of the House of Representatives, and John Boehner refused to put it there. And then in September, when we went back to Washington, D.C., Boehner again held that up. I think that's thoroughly unacceptable. This is something that had bipartisan support, at least getting it to the floor. I engaged in a number of discussions on a bipartisan basis with a number of folks in the House of Representatives, because we knew that we, in fact, had bipartisan support to bring it to the floor, to have a vote on that bill. And I have no doubt something would have passed, you know, even with revisions and amendments, and then sent over to the House so that there could be a conference committee to work on it. The farm bill expired on September 30th. This is not good for farmers. They need to have some certainty. They have to be able to, they want to know what's going to happen, especially come the next planting season. So this is unacceptable, to say the least. And this is one where I really do lay it at the feet of Speaker Boehner, because he's really held this up, and it's really unfortunate. And look, my opponent, he's going to have a fundraiser with John Boehner at the Country Club in Davenport in a couple of days. I certainly hope he'll bring this up with the Speaker of the House.
We have covered a number of issues here. Is there anything that I haven't talked about that is a key issue for you, something you're hearing about as you've been campaigning, that you want to bring up?
Well, Jason, I appreciate you having me on. I really do. I just think this is wonderful that that you know you talk to us about what's happening and get the word out to folks who are listening in on this. But again, it comes back to the economy and jobs, and we know that we can't let other issues get in the way. But when we talk about jobs and the economy, and I talk about the middle class, you know, I'm talking about folks who are out there in the workforce. And folks who are worried about losing their jobs. As I said, those who've never been in the middle class. But we're talking about our veterans. We're talking about our troops in uniform. And when they come back, making sure that they can be a part of that middle class with those post-9/11 GI benefits and making sure they get the proper health care. And we're talking about seniors who are in the middle class in their golden years after they've worked a lifetime and put money into Social Security and contributed to Medicare. They should not have the rug pulled out from under them, because they would literally be thrown into the ranks of a poor, and that's unacceptable. So when we talk about the middle class, it covers a lot of ground, and I just appreciate you letting me talk about those issues.